National Gallery Podcast.
This is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. This month we start with a new exhibition at the gallery. It's devoted to the 19th century artist Peder Balcke, and is one of the first ever to take place outside his home country of Norway. Long forgotten, Balcke is today increasingly recognised as an important precursor of modern painters. His subject was Norway itself, and in particular, the eerie isolated terrain of the Arctic Circle. It was to provide Balcke with decades of inspiration, as the first room of the National Gallery exhibition neatly demonstrates. Visitors can compare four versions of the same scene: the stormy cape at the northernmost tip of Norway, made at intervals throughout the artist's career. Cathy Fitzgerald met up with curator Christopher Riopel to hear about the voyage that sparked the young painter's fascination with the rugged landscape.
In 1832, Balcke decided to do something quite remarkable for an artist. He was in love with the Norwegian landscape, but he decided that he would go and seek out its most remote, its most desolate, its most distant points by sailing up the west coast of Norway as far as he could go. And he reached the so-called North Cape, that mighty rock formation at the very top of this long nation. And it became, for Balcke, a leitmotif of his career. That is, over the years, he kept returning in memory and with his paintbrush to what he had seen there in 1832. And then, very near the end of his painting life, in about 1870, he paints the North Cape yet again in what may be the largest single painting of his career, a monumental canvas with the North Cape at the center of a huge landscape. But now it's almost a ghost presence. It's just very subtle shades of white across the middle of the canvas that, because we've come to recognize the North Cape from so many pictures, we say, ah, there it is again, but it doesn't look like it does in any of the other pictures.
It's almost as if somehow he's captured that action of memory, isn't it? It's as if the details are being stripped away and you've just got the essence that has been sort of left over time.
I think that's very much the point. He did not need to see the North Cape again. After all those years, it was so completely embedded in his mind, in his imagination, that he could evoke it, and he could evoke it over and over again in different ways, each time finding something special about it, something special about this icon of Norwegianness, if we can call it that.
Is it possible there was something personal there as well that sort of spoke to him more directly?
It is, as I say, a great solitary object there in nature. And Balcke himself was a solitary. He spent much of his youth, certainly, traveling alone, walking across the face of Northern Europe, walking to Germany, being entirely independent as a human being. He had, I think, an extraordinary sense of self. And that, too, may be something that is emerging in this constant return to the motif of the North Cape. In imagination, if you will, the storm grows. It becomes wilder and more dangerous with each retelling, as, of course, is often the case with adventures.
Thanks to Christopher Riopel. And you can find the Peder Balcke exhibition in the Sunley Room until spring 2015. Admission is free. And now to our acclaimed exhibition, Rembrandt the Late Works. One picture astounding viewers, despite substantial damage by fire in the 18th century, is Rembrandt's group portrait of the Amsterdam Guild of Surgeons, the anatomy lesson of Dr. Jan Damen of 1656. The surviving portion of the painting shows Dr. Damen dissecting the brain of a corpse who lies with his feet sticking directly out at the gallery-goer. It's a gruesome scene, and the fact that anatomical subjects in the 17th century were usually executed criminals can add to the drama for modern viewers. But how accurate is Rembrandt's depiction? We invited Peter Abrahams, Professor of Clinical Anatomy at Warwick University, to give his verdict.
It is absolutely correct. I have just spent 15 minutes looking at it in every angle possible without a magnifying glass because I didn't want to get arrested.
Could you teach from this picture?
Not only could I teach, I could teach the layers of the brain and what lies within one of those layers, which is a blood vessel, a dural venous sinus, that drains from the front to the back of the brain as it is literally being peeled away between the two hemispheres, and you can see the forceps that are lifting it out between the gap in the midline.
So for you as a clinical anatomist, you can look at this and you know exactly what's going on. Rembrandt's not fudged anything here.
I don't think he's fudged anything. I think he's sat through a dissection, an anatomy, and he's drawn from what he saw. I could reproduce that picture within 10 minutes in a dissecting room in London.
Now, there are a couple of other things that I'm really rather curious about with the picture. The one is that the angle of the corpse's head on his chest, that seems a little bit exaggerated. And the other are his enormous and extremely three-dimensional grubby feet that seem to be protruding out. What about those?
Well, that's part of the perspective. In fact, I would say exactly the opposite. I think the feet should be bigger. I think artistically, he's not done the feet very well. They're lovely and grubby. He was a criminal who'd just been hung. But they're actually, for proportion, a little too small. But obviously, I think he was, you know, copying other people who'd done foreshortening paintings, Lamentations of Christ, that sort of thing. And I just think that the movement of the head is actually how we would put the head if we were doing that dissection now.
It seems that the only thing that's missing is the smell.
But if it's in the winter, when most dissections, most anatomies were done, the bodies wouldn't smell until about day 3 or 4.
So it's a bit of a winter sport, is it, anatomy?
I don't think sport is the right word, but I know what you mean. It's definitely something up until embalming occurred, because remember, none of these bodies are embalmed at this time. Until embalming occurred, it was definitely something that was good to do in the winter and a nightmare to do in the summer.
Rembrandt The Late Works is sponsored by Shell and will run through to the 18th of January. Tickets are available from the National Gallery or online without a booking fee at nationalgallery.org.uk. And now, as it's nearly Christmas, to one of the most tender nativity scenes in the gallery. Nativity at Night by the Netherlandish artist Geertgen Tot Sint-Jans depicts a familiar image, the infant Christ in the manger surrounded by worshippers, in an unfamiliar way. The stable seems to be lit by candles, but in fact, the light that fills the faces of Mary and a host of tiny, astonished angels comes from a much stranger source, the baby himself. Under the soft-eyed gaze of an ox, Christ levitates in his crib, streaming rays of light. Although odd to us, this idea of an illuminated Christ child wouldn't have surprised Geertgen's original audience. It comes from the writings of the 14th-century mystic St. Bridget of Sweden. As art historian Paula Nuttall explained to Cathy.
St. Bridget of Sweden was an aristocratic Swedish lady who went on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land in the year 1370. And when she was in Bethlehem, she had a vision in which the Virgin Mary told her how the Nativity had been. And one of the things that Mary said was that having given birth to the Christ child painlessly and instantaneously, the child emitted such a brilliant radiance that it eclipsed the light from St. Joseph's candle. And Geertgen has beautifully illustrated this, because if you look in the shadows at the top right-hand side of the painting, you will just discern the figure of St. Joseph. And you may be able to see that his right hand is actually shielding the flame of a candle. Now, we can't sadly see the candle anymore because the painting has been cut down. But you can perhaps see that his face is lit by a slightly ruddy glow, as if from candlelight, and that contrasts dramatically with this sort of silvery, luminous, much more divine, I think, radiance that's emanating from the child and illuminating the faces of Mary and the angels.
And there are other tiny sources of light as well, aren't there?
Yes, in the background you can see dimly the figures of the shepherds around their campfire. And they are reacting quite dramatically with sort of upraised hands to this extraordinary apparition in the sky, which is, of course, the angel who has come to tell them that Christ has been born in Bethlehem and that they must run to the stable.
And it's the most beautiful of angels, isn't it? Just hovering.
Absolutely hovering. And so ethereal. And again, the contrast between this sort of almost phosphorescent, sort of silvery light with which he's just stroked in the form of the semi-transparent angel, and then the much yellower light of the shepherd's fire, again, makes the same kind of contrast as you have in the foreground between the child and Saint Joseph.
And how would it have been used?
It would, of course, have been made for private prayer within the home, which, of course, suits its very intimate, sort of contemplative nature. And one thing that I think is worth noting is that although there are lots of figures clustered around the manger, the Virgin, the angels, the ox and the ass, the foreground is left empty. And I think that's perhaps because the person who would have been praying in front of it was intended to visualize him or herself as one of the people who's completing the circle of worshippers around the manger.
And of course, they would have been looking at the picture in candlelight probably as well.
Absolutely, yes, that's a really good point. They would have been, yeah, I'm sure.
Thanks to Paula Nuttall. Gitgen's Nativity at Night is on display in Room 63, and if you're visiting in the next few weeks, you might like to know that it's part of the gallery's Nativity Trail, which follows the Christmas story through six paintings in the collection. See the website before you visit to download the trail for free. We're open 10 till 6 daily and till 9 on Fridays, as usual during the holidays, with the exception of the 24th to the 26th of December and the 1st of January, when the gallery will be closed. That's it for this episode. Season's greetings. Until next year, goodbye.